My name is Rory Sutherland. I'm the Vice Chairman of Ogilvy & Mather in the UK, and we're here based in Sea Containers on the South Bank in London. I also write a weekly column for The Spectator called The Wiki Man. My job is to persuade people in all walks of life that quite often the best way to solve a problem is by changing the way people think rather than changing physical reality. My greatest life lesson is really that whatever you do in life, try and be good at two things that are perhaps interconnected.
So I read somewhere that you don't like the term career.
I may have been there channeling a comment Jeremy Bulmore made once, where he said, I've never really had a career, I've had a series of jobs. But to describe it as a career is really a kind of post-rationalization of your life. Yes, I mean, you can always portray events from the past as though they were linear and planned and intended. I think the reality at the time is that there's always a degree of randomness. Now, I've always worked at the same place in some shape. So I joined Ogilvy in 1988. Yep. So it'd be very, very easy to portray what I've done as if it were one simple linear progression of things. In reality, it's involved quite a lot of randomness. I've done completely different jobs within the same organisation over that time. One advantage of Ogilvy is it's at least big enough for you to find variety without necessarily having to change employer. So I also think that you might say that the danger with career is it encourages too much forward planning.
Right.
And I'm a little bit in favour, particularly in the modern world, where, let's be honest, I mean, half of the job titles in this building didn't even exist when I joined the industry. So I can't remember what it is, but I mean, there's a very large percentage of people in London who have a kind of job description which literally did not exist in 1995.
Head of content.
And so if that pace of change, exactly, head of content being a perfect example.
Head of digital.
So if that pace of change continues, the idea of having a career and planning what you want to do as though you can is really a little bit of a pretense.
So what would you say to a young person today, like me? I mean, I don't feel that young anymore. I'm nearly 30, but I feel I have just dabbled in so many different things, and I feel under a lot of pressure, especially, you know, when I was trying to get a job in the creative industry, in advertising, you know, they would look at my CV and be like, well, what are you? And I don't really know because I'm figuring it out.
That actually is one of the worst aspects of employment, which is that we employ to fill positions rather than employing people and then working out roles around them. And I think, you know, it's probably a necessity for counting purposes. I've had friends, for example, very good friend Brian Miller, and the problem he had in finding conventional employment was that he was good at two things. And they said, well, we don't really know where to place you because you can actually do copywriting and you can do strategic planning. And what should have been undoubtedly a source of competitive advantage for him in the job market ended up being a problem. And it's kind of crazy. And one of the things I would recommend is, a certain degree of randomness, certainly early in your career, in the long term pays off because it gives you versatility and it gives you breadth. And, you know, one of the fashionable phrases now in HR is people who are, for example, T-shaped or U-shaped or M-shaped or whatever it may be. But the idea that the modern employee, in truth, has to be good at more than one thing. Or at least you have to be very good and with depth in one thing, but you need to have breadth in a variety of related fields. That doesn't seem to be, although, you know, fashionable though the phrase may be, it doesn't seem to me totally nonsense.
Well, okay, let me read this to you. Correct me if I'm wrong. So you read classics at Christ College. You joined Ogilvy in 1988 as part of a graduate trainee scheme where you were named the worst graduate trainee that Ogilvy ever hired. Then you were fired from the planning department, sent to creative.
I reapplied, in fact. I reapplied.
Okay. Yeah. You became a copywriter. 5 years later, you were executive creative director of Ogilvy One.
Yeah.
And now Vice Chairman of Ogilvy UK. How?
Okay, well, to be honest, the fact that people's early stage careers are slightly messy or non-linear shouldn't be in any way a mark of shame, because for two reasons. First of all, this whole business was founded by someone who had the most extraordinary early working life, where I think he'd variously been a chef, an Argus salesman, a failed tobacco farmer, and of course a researcher before he even founded Ogilvy & Mather when he was in his 40s. Okay. So he was always conscious of the fact that when he started Ogilvy & Mather, he had a CV which would have meant effectively that no one else would have given him a job.
Yep.
And so was fairly sympathetic to people with slightly arcane backgrounds. But I don't think we should also apologise about the fact that people's early working life is messy, because as work gets in some ways more and more specialised, time spent dicking around finding out what it is you really want to do isn't really wasted.
Yeah.
It may seem so at the time, but actually a surprising amount of what I learned, even being a bad account person, is still of value to me today. Other things to add to that, I think, would be actually it wasn't altogether unplanned, because as part of the graduate recruitment scheme, we were hired, four of us, in 1988 as part of Ogilvy & Mather Direct, which was the direct marketing wing of Ogilvy. And as part of our training, we spent 2 or 3 weeks with different disciplines and in different departments of the agency.
Mm.
And it was fairly clear to me within at least minutes of joining, of doing my 2 week stint in the creative department, that's what I wanted to do long term.
Mm-hmm.
That everything from the nature of the work, the challenge of the work, the instinctive enjoyment I drew from sort of problem solving, and just the culture of the department itself, which was very, very, which was truly remarkable. Mm-hmm. It's worth remembering, you had a department which I suppose was notionally headed by Drayton Bird, who is the great guru and still is of direct marketing. Fantastic early mentor.
Mm-hmm.
You had Steve Harrison there as a copywriter, later head of copy.
Mm-hmm.
There are people, Mike Sim, Randy Haunfelder. If you run through the kind of telephone list from the creative department in that era, it was truly an extraordinary collection of people. I mean, really remarkable collection of people. So that was yet another reason why the creative department was a particular beacon.
Mm.
So part of the messiness was just reflected the difficulty of reinventing yourself as a copywriter when you'd been hired as a graduate trainee under the assumption that you were going to become an account man. Now, I think subsequently we've loosened that a bit, and that when we hire people, we don't necessarily hire people for the Ogilvy Fellowship with massively strong preconceptions about where they're going to end up.
Mm.
I was right. But, you know, within a few months of joining the creative department, there was obviously a learning curve, and I probably produced my fair share of rubbish work to begin with, to be absolutely honest. It was fairly clear that not only did I enjoy it immensely, but I had some reasonable element of talent there as well.
So how does someone without a creative background get your attention?
Well, in order to be recruited?
Yeah.
Well, one thing we've done here at Ogilvy, which I'll talk about and always try and talk about in such conversations, is we founded a thing called The Pipe.
Love The Pipe.
The point about The Pipe is that we realised that we were essentially, in terms of gaining talent from outside the industry, other than poaching people from within the industry, we, and to be candid, the rest of the industry, were all fishing in the same goddamn ponds.
Mm-mm.
Now, we shouldn't complain about that too much, because we can successfully fish in ponds like, you know, Ivy League graduates, Oxbridge graduates, etc. And, you know, the construction industry would kill to have the appeal that the advertising industry still has towards graduates generally. It's seen as not ridiculously, because it's probably a career which is, you know, generally quite interesting and tolerably remunerative.
Yeah.
In other words, it's a way of actually doing a creative job without necessarily starving in a garret for the first 8 years. So, you know, but the fact that we have that appeal is something we shouldn't turn our back on, because some very good people in the industry come from that background. But the idea that that's the only place where we should look is patently ridiculous.
Mm.
And so, you know, recruitment has become more and more systematized. And I think there's actually a very interesting problem, which I almost counts as a paradox, which is the more people want to make recruitment look fair and methodical and rigorous, the more homogeneous it becomes.
I was going to ask you about women in advertising, actually.
Well, the point is that if you're recruiting people, you need, in order to look fair, you need to apply the same criteria to everybody. Mm-hmm. That's a requirement of fairness. The only problem about applying the same criteria to everybody is that everybody you choose is then the same. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've ranted quite extensively about this ludicrous 2-1 or an above rule, which is the weirdest, which is, I mean, all it is, it's a totally arbitrary rule. There's no evidence to suggest that people with firsts are any better than people with thirds in the industry. If there were evidence, then maybe I'd change my mm-hmm. mind, but I haven't seen any. Mm-hmm. Some of the best people I've worked with have got thirds, actually. And it's also, by the way, the nature of the advertising industry that it's a complicated beast. And as an industry, what makes it very rewarding to work in is that there's room in the industry for chin-stroking intellectuals, and there's room for what you might call raw talent, mm-hmm. you know, just raw innate talent. And so to work as a decent agency, the mixture of people isn't just a byproduct, it's actually essential to the functioning of any agency. So what we've done with The Pipe is we've created a completely I suppose what you might say is it's a completely orthogonal process of recruitment, where we just look for interesting ideas in people without any interest in their academic background, or indeed their age, or indeed their origins. The purpose being to have a different set of criteria to hire a different group of people. Again, where those people end up, they're mostly aimed for the creative department, maybe, and that's what they want to do. But there's no necessity in that. And I think you've got to understand this. It's a very interesting paradox, which is the need to appear fair and the need to appear scientific forces you then to deploy measures and metrics which you apply to all people equally. By the very act of applying the same metrics. Now, here's an interesting, it's a philosophical question, but I'll ask it nonetheless, which is, if you're recruiting for, let's say, admission to a university, okay, it's very, very nice to be able to say, okay, we're going to just take the applicants who have the best A-level results, and that's it. If they don't have 3 A's, they're not coming in. Now, it's a very safe thing to do, because you can always defend your decision, because it appears to be rigorous and it also appears to be fair.
Yeah.
But the problems arise, one, of course, people game the system. And the people who can best game the system are often the people with the most resources to spare. Mm-hmm. So people who've had the benefit of private education, people who have the contacts to, for example, do work experience in 3 ad agencies, mm-hmm. those are the people who can actually game the system best. Whereas people who don't know anybody in advertising and who live in Merthyr Tydfil have very little opportunity to play those kind of games. I spoke to someone actually who got a third at university, and they said, I've got great career prospects, they said, simply because my mum lives in London. Said, all my other friends, they live miles away, they find it really difficult to get a job because they've got the expense of accommodation. The second they take a short-term job, they're almost, or they take work experience, they're almost killed by the accommodation costs. My mum lives in London. I can do that as often as I like. I've met people who've got a 2-2 in maths from Cambridge and they can't get an interview. Now, trust me, okay? If you've got into Cambridge to do maths, you can handle 99.9% of the mathematical problems that will face you in 30 years in the advertising industry. There may be a few specialist jobs where you require extraordinary advanced statistical skills, but let's face it, you're already more mathematically gifted than pretty much everybody in the building. Mm-hmm. So to use that as a criterion for rejection is completely bonkers. Mm-hmm. So one of the vital things about The Pipe is it's absolutely essential that we don't create this stupidly narrow kind of entrance mm-hmm. gate through which only a particular kind of person can pass. Mm-hmm. That's not in the long-term interest of the business. Even better, The Pipe was started as an initiative by a group of creative people.
I was going to say, how long has it been running for?
This is our first year running into the second.
Oh, okay.
It's been pretty damn successful so far.
Yeah.
As far as I know, all but one or two of the people are ending up with jobs. I mean,
that's great.
And it's a really, really useful thing, simply because And by the way, there's no reason why you can't apply to the pipe if you've got a first in mathematics at Cambridge.
Yeah, yeah.
It's absolutely vital that we have diverse and variable criteria for admission to this business. Otherwise, it just becomes appallingly homogeneous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might say there are some businesses in which homogeneity is a bit of a plus. You know, you probably don't want, like, rogue rock star actuaries down the end of the building. This is emphatically not one of those businesses.
What about, okay, so this is from your book. You're saying the most dangerous people were the stupid and energetic people, but the clever and lazy people ranked highly.
Yes, this is not me. This actually comes from a German general, variously, I think, von Moltke, or one of those people. And they ranked people, I think, in the Prussian army. And they found the stupid and energetic are particularly dangerous because they will put enormous amounts of energy and resource into doing the wrong thing.
Mm.
It's a distinction, I think, also made in business strategy between doing the right thing and doing things right.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a distinction to be made.
Mm-hmm.
You can put a huge amount of energy into very efficiently doing something which is stupid.
Yep.
And you can put a very small amount of energy into doing something which is quite simple and which is worthwhile. Energetic and stupid people, or energetic and misdirected people, can be very dangerous. Generally, the intelligent and lazy are quite valuable because in some ways there's an aspect to laziness which is not totally disconnected from creativity, which is you'd rather sit and think about an easier way of doing something than plough in and try and solve a problem by brute force.
Yes.
So there probably is some sort of correlation in people between idleness and ingenuity.
Mm-hmm. I read you say somewhere, I think it was in your book as well, that it's worth calling in sick.
That was a David Ogilvy piece of advice. David Ogilvy's advice, less necessary perhaps now in the days of the PVR, but one of David Ogilvy's things was to call in sick once every few months and spend the day watching television.
Mm.
So you would actually see the television that your target audience saw rather than the television you saw in the evening. But David Ogilvy, I think, also favoured calling in sick because probably, I think, the kind of work many people in this building do, it's high intensity, short burst activity.
Mm.
And if you're not careful and if you don't pace yourself right, particularly as you get older, you will get burnt out. But also, episodic periods of idleness, I don't think, are a bad thing for the human brain.
How do you keep inspired?
The one quality I always look for in people is curiosity. The one thing that would be a deal breaker, I think, in employing someone in an advertising department in a creative role would be someone who is fundamentally incurious.
Mm-hmm.
And so most people I find, you know, you work with in a business like this are innately interested in things.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you can quote, I think, Ogilvy. Ogilvy described a copywriter as an extensive browser in all kinds of fields. There's a wonderful definition which you can find and put up on the screen, which I can't remember verbatim, but which Dave Trott borrowed from Ed McCabe, which is that, you know, the quality of the creative person is they can get interested in pretty much anything.
Mm.
And so most creative people, I think, don't actually require tricks to stimulate them. They're just that way.
Mm. What are the things that fascinate you the most, other than trains and
curry houses and true life crime and air crashes? I'm interested in all of those four to an insane degree. They are slightly connected, by the way. I don't know about the train thing. A lot of people in this business are weirdly fascinated by trains.
It's
as
an
well.
Autism thing, I feel.
Yeah, no, it is. I am a tiny bit on the spectrum, a little bit on the spectrum. The trains thing is partly it's the workings of a system.
Okay.
So it's like understanding how a complex system works,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And the air crashes stroke true life crime stroke creative thing is not unconnected. And to understand that, it's quite good to see a quotation, which is in, I think, A Study in Scarlet by Conan Doyle, where Sherlock Holmes talks about what he calls reverse reasoning.
Interesting.
Now, what the human brain has evolved to do is to answer the question, what happens next? Ooh, look, this person is leaning over the edge of the building. They're going to fall.
Mm.
That's what you might call predictive, okay? Now, the solving of the criminal investigation, hence why Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, is the reverse of that, which is we have this state of affairs. What could previously have happened to have led to this corpse being in the bottom of the river? So that requires reverse reasoning, which is fundamentally different and more open-ended than what you might call induction.
Okay.
Or deduction. I always get them muddled up. They are different. Like, don't ask me to tell me which way around to do it.
I'll take
either. I get totally baffled.
I'll let you know.
But there's something there about which is similar to the creative task or the behavioural science task in advertising, which is, wouldn't it be better if people did this rather than that?
Yeah.
What preconditions could we put in place? What cues in the environment before the decision might lead them to do X rather than Y?
Mm-hmm.
And that, just as a detective investigation, involves effectively reasoning backwards.
What is the most interesting thing you've learnt about human behaviour?
Probably the extent to which our actions precede our reasons. That a large part of consciousness seems to delude us, that we think and reason and then act. To a very great extent, our decisions are emotionally driven and they are post-rationalized in retrospect. And it's quite difficult getting your head around that for other people.
Mm.
Getting your head about it around it for yourself is even harder. And so the way we pretend we think, act and decide doesn't bear that, and the way we are convinced we think, act and decide doesn't bear much relation to the real cognitive reality. Let me tell you where fear of the obvious sometimes goes wrong, okay? So a few years ago, we have this toaster at home and it starts effectively bursting into flames, shorting out. Strange little pieces of smoke come out of it when you put a thicker loaf in. And part of the problem is it was just too damn narrow. If you put thick bread in, it didn't really work. Mm-mm-mm. Bits of bread fell off, they caught fire.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife sends me out to the shops to dutifully go and buy a wide slot toaster. About an hour and a half, I come back through the door. I can barely manoeuvre this flaming box through the door, and what I've bought is an electronic bread slicer. And I announced, ta-da! I said, we don't need a wider toaster, what we need is narrower bread. Okay. Now that is the creative person as arsehole, okay? It was a daft decision, because shortly afterwards we had children, the bread slicer turned into a bloody, you know, practically a biohazard, because they were going to lose their fingers through the thing. It had a vast rate revolving blade. It also took up about 90% of the surface area of the kitchen. It's in a cupboard. It's in a cupboard somewhere. We now have a wide slot toaster, just as my wife originally suggested. But nonetheless, your job as a creative person is to go, This is what nearly everybody would do. What else could you do? Is there a way of reframing this problem in a way that makes the solution different? And any creative person will tell you this. If you've redefined the problem, you've probably solved it. So the reason people get stuck on a problem is because they're fixated on one particular definition or frame of that problem, and they're looking at the problem in a particular way which renders it unsolvable. If you can just take the same problem and look at it from a different direction, or you reverse the polarity of how you're looking at it, or you change the frame of reference, sometimes something that was hugely complicated and unsolvable before becomes really, really easy to solve. So as a result, you are wired after a certain length of time in any creative department to look for weird ways of re-looking at the damn problem.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, sometimes that works, and sometimes it's ridiculous. Where you direct your attention affects what you deem to be important. You can't control what you feel is important, but you can control where you direct your attention, and thereby hack yourself into changing your priorities and the things that matter to you. And one thing I've managed to do is having a conversation with a cameraman exactly about commuting, is that most people have kind of trained themselves to look at the negatives of commuting. Mm-hmm. And they find commuting irritating, time-consuming, and they generally rant about how terrible their commute is. If you have a pleasant one-hour train journey at the beginning of your day, it's perfectly possible to focus on the positive aspects of that journey, mm-hmm. so you turn it into something which is enjoyable and looked forward to, rather than something which is actually an hour carved out of your life that you'll never get back. Mm. And so that lesson that actually, I can quote Shakespeare, that's a bit farty, isn't it?
Please do.
Which is, it's Hamlet, technically, isn't it? There's nothing either good nor bad, but only thinking makes it so, is a pretty useful lesson. Mm-hmm. There's a really interesting thing also that you can, that don't always change reality, change perception. Before you move house, okay, if you're thinking of going through all the expense of moving house, ask yourself, actually say, well, moving house by its nature is going to cost you sort of £10,000 of various things. What about just keeping my existing house and rearranging the furniture completely? So making a room a completely, adding a completely yeah. different function to a room. You might achieve 90% of the benefits, actually, with, 5% of the cost. Mm-hmm. You can, and also just changing the way you perceive things is within our control. Greatest thing, my favorite plant, as you'll know, the chili. I was telling you this earlier, chilies aren't hot. They're not burning your skin, they're not harming you. The way capsaicin works, which is the active chemical within really spicy chilies, it doesn't burn your skin. The reason it was evolved was to prevent certain animals eating the fruit, I think, or
makes
the plant.
Sense.
Okay? Now, you could produce a fruit that was really, really hot, but it's difficult for nature to do that. Now, so what capsaicin does is it tampers with our perception mechanism. So it actually tampers with the receptors so that the thing that isn't hot feels hot.
Is that like the same thing as when you wash your hands under boiling hot water, it starts to feel cold?
Yeah. So what it does is it just recalibrates your senses in certain areas of taste and skin perception so that you feel a degree of pain even though it's not doing you any harm at all.
Wow.
That's fucking weird, isn't it?
Wow. So can you train yourself to...
Well, this is an interesting question. I don't know if you can... this is actually the... if you want to get really interesting about that, if you look at what capsaicin does, there is a huge... If I owned a lot of stock in a lot of corporations, there is a massive existential threat to a large part of capitalism, which is the development of designer drugs that create the same emotional effect as expensive possessions, but merely in pill form. So an interesting one would be the worldwide cosmetics and beauty industry, which I think women spend something like $3 trillion a year on cosmetics and fashion. Okay, now some part of that is to impress their friends, some part of it is to attract the opposite sex. A very large part of it is actually just to feel good with yourself.
Okay? I want to look in the mirror and not hate my
now,
face.
What if you could produce a drug that made women feel really well-dressed without having to go through all that farty trouble of putting things on your eyebrows?
That made me feel well-dressed, but I wasn't
now,
actually.
Arguably, you see, there is a drug that makes men feel really attractive and suave. And it's called 4 pints of lager, basically. Okay?
Now,
after
it's
three or 4 pints
thing.
Of lager, essentially most blokes become transmogrified into George Clooney in their own mind, okay? Now, if you achieve the same drug that achieved the same effect as L'Oreal or achieved the same effect as Versace, but in pill form.
I wouldn't buy it.
You think that'd be cheating? I think it'd be fantastic.
I would just I like the process of getting ready, of putting on makeup. It's an achievement. It's a canvas.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just being a woman.
No. There is an interesting question, which is it might not work if the drug were too easy to take. So here's a really interesting one, which is that maybe there needs to be a degree of effort to make the reward seem plausible. So what we're doing is we're essentially hacking our unconscious here. That in other words, by putting on makeup and by wearing a fancy frock, you just feel better about yourself and facing the world. Mm. I know this because I have long conversations. One of my daughters is like a militant feminist. Or to be actually accurate, she's a militant feminist until there's a wasp. Okay? But nonetheless, We have arguments about this. I said, you know, I thought the great thing about you becoming a feminist was that you become really quick at leaving the house.
Dad, I've become a feminist.
Yeah, no, she's announced it very, very seriously. I thought that'll be great because it'll be really quick to leave the house. You'll just have to put on some dungarees,
yeah,
maybe
no
splash
bra,
a bit of, no bra, bit of paint on your clothes, and you can leave the house.
Stop washing,
I thought that's going to be really easy. Nope. Now, apparently modern feminism, you fart around with this stuff just as much as you as anybody else
does.
Oh,
I've got that wrong.
Yeah. So, and she explains that she does it entirely for herself, which is undoubtedly true, you know, mostly true. But I'm always intrigued by that, which is, you know, is it partly that... I mean, I slightly worry about this. What happens when standards of appearance become so high that they become ridiculously time-consuming?
I think that's happened.
You think, I think it's already
happened. Oh, gosh.
Now, I wanted to have rules in Ogilvy to save women having to worry about fashion, that we'd actually, for 4 days out of every five, fifth day, you can all get dressed up, do your thing, right?
Yeah.
For the first 4 days, everybody would wear like overalls, a bit like it. You know those headquarters of a James Bond villain?
Yeah.
James Bond villain, yeah. Everybody goes around in red overalls. Yeah. You know, the great thing about those things is those villains didn't have to spend a load of time going, do
like
I wear the blue
uniform.
Overalls? Do I wear the red
That's
overalls?
The best thing
Put
about
the fucking
going
overalls
to school
in.
With a uniform.
Yeah.
Done.
No
I
agony.
I know exactly what I'm wearing. You can't judge me. I don't have anything cool on because we all look exactly the same.
Burkas as well.
The
I mean, you could do the burka.
Please start an Ogilvy uniform.
So the Ogilvy uniform is just, okay. Okay,
orange
here
jumpsuits.
It is, just exactly, orange jumpsuit. Place would
Maybe
look fantastic.
Numbers.
Yeah,
like prison
nice
style.
Idea. That'd be great.
Yeah, creative department.
Actually, that's not a
Come
bad idea.
Come on.
Actually, this is quite a good idea.
It's actually a really good idea.
I have
idea.
A really mischievous idea, right, which is a good practical joke I want to play, which is just getting, right, a random person who you know, and when you turn up at their party, you all agree, okay, to turn up simultaneously wearing those forensics outfits, so all the neighbours assume there's been a murder. So you turn up in a white van, you all get out just carrying little boxes and makeup brushes while wearing those white all over body coveralls. So everybody else in the street
That's
is basically convinced they're
idea.
Serial killers. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
You could put a tent up in their back garden
no,
as well.
Too far.
You think that's going
no,
too far?
Too far. Okay, or get the dogs.
Too...
No, it's
no,
too
dogs
far.
Dogs would be good. That's a good idea. Dogs. Yeah,
no,
really
but really,
yeah,
the
okay,
uniform
sorry.
I think could really work.
So I'm in favour of that, but unfortunately nobody else in Ogilvy will back me on this obviously egalitarian and well-intentioned move.
Well, let's see.
They look, I mean, those James Bond headquarters
look
fucking
cool.
great, don't they?
Yeah, they look really
I agree.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, are you afraid of anything in the future?
Oh. Yeah. Okay, first bit sounds a bit wanky, but it's basically true, which is that every creative person slightly has that fear that they lose the ability to do it.
I was going to ask you, do you see that day coming anytime soon? And what are the sort of the signs that you're going to look out for? Or not, no, I don't think you can ever stop being creative, but where the time comes and you just think, you know what, I've got to switch off, I have to stop
it's
solving
weird,
problems.
Isn't it? I mean, there's a general belief which may be very self-damaging that you lose it as you get older. And now what's interesting about
that
is it varies. So it's very different in very different areas of art creativity. So that architecture, I mean, the Daniel Libeskind, who of course has done the Holocaust Museum and so forth, he didn't get a single building of his built until he was 50. Yeah. Frank Lloyd Wright's best work was done really, really late in life. So architecture's patently one where there's a combination of learning and what you might call enthusiasm, but that you do get better over time.
Mm.
And there are other areas like, you know, really advanced mathematics where if you haven't done it by 40, you can basically forget about it. Now, the interesting question is, which of those two is that job? We're always a business full of young people. Some creative directors have the belief that every creative team kind of has a 2 or 3 year high point period in their career where they just hit unexpected heights, and your job as a recruiter is to hire them for those 3 years after. Now, the only thing about that is that may be true, but I'd feel unbelievably callous if I were to believe in it.
Yeah.
So I kind of, one of the things I choose not to believe. I also think that with the right frameworks and with the right way of looking at things, I think you can turn creativity from being something which is accretive, where you do actually get better because you learn techniques and you learn And you just develop skills and instincts over time, which get better, rather than being something which is just like a weird hormonal flush in a particular period of your life.
When I was working in a few agencies, I found that the more I was aware of what was going on in the advertising industry, the less creative I became, because I just found myself knowing every campaign that was out, and just when I had a brief to solve, I would think, oh, it could be like that. I would just end up stealing ideas.
This is a really interesting problem, which is actually, in the early stages of your career, by the way, when you're younger, looking at really good ads, just immersing yourself in DNAD books, is actually a really good approach.
Yeah.
I would argue once you get to about 35 or 40, or it depends how long you've been in the industry, you need to stop doing that and you need to look for inspiration somewhere else. Because the first stage is understanding the standards, understanding what good looks like, learning that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But at some stage, the industry becomes a bit of a bloody echo chamber. I find Cannes a bit painful because I'm going, actually, we shouldn't be trying to impress each other, which most people in the advertising industry spend their lives trying to impress other advertising people.
Yeah.
So what really rewards me occasionally is going and giving a talk on creativity or behavioural science to an audience of cardiac surgeons, and they come out afterwards and go, that was really useful, I'd never thought of it like that before.
This actually brings me on to the Pepsi ad question I had for you, which is trial by social media and how basically, correct me again if I'm wrong, but everyone within the advertising industry saw that ad and was like, it's shit, this is wrong with it, that's wrong, that's wrong. Everyone outside of the advertising industry was like, what's wrong with it?
What's to blame for it is the fact that the mainstream media take these selective group of objecting posts, cut and paste, and use it to create a crisis or a scandal where none really exists.
Just everyone was jumping on the Twitter bandwagon. I was one of them.
Well,
seeing the Pepsi ad, what the hell? And then I deleted it because I felt like
There are some problems with that ad, which is what the hell's Kylie Jenner doing there?
Yeah.
It did get sarky comments from the daughter of Coretta Scott King and Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
It was a little bit too, I'll tell you what it was, kind of like it's strategic bra straps were showing.
Yeah.
It was a little bit of VPL. Yeah. What it was trying to do was too nakedly apparent.
Yeah.
And it didn't get away with it. But, and it's worth remembering that when you do any of that kind of issue-based or what you might call mission-based advertising, you're walking a pretty fine line.
Yeah.
If there are thousands of people misunderstanding your advertisement, willfully or not, you've got a problem.
Yeah.
What actually happens instead is that 10 people misunderstand it, express their outrage. Mm. In the old days, newspaper reporting actually involved getting out of the office and going and visiting people to canvass their opinions. And therefore, mad people with extreme opinions were difficult to find because there weren't very many of them. On Twitter, if you want to create a scandal, all you do is go, there'll be some mad people here. Oh, look, here they are. Hashtag blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Cut and paste.
Yeah.
Put it in the newspaper.
Too easy.
Too easy.
It's too easy.
And it's the mainstream media, not the social media, that are most to blame, because they take what is a totally minority whack job opinion and they make it seem a mainstream opinion through magnifying it and giving it credibility through its appearance in the pages of the New York Times as distinct from on Twitter. If you listen to talk radio, which I do a lot, I like talk radio, I like phone-in radio, it's kind of free market research. LBC, basically, the aggregate of opinion that arises through listening to phone-in radio is quite interesting because people disagree with each other. Generally, people who are loonies, maybe they don't ring up, maybe they're obviously loonies, but they don't actually dominate the debate or the discussion because there's, a kind of consensus emerges.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, the way in which the press, in its desperate need, then what all it needs to do is ring a few of those organisations which are effectively funded to support the permanently aggrieved. In other words, you phone the Glorification of Victimhood charity number 275. You ask them for a quote. Now, if you're working as a spokesman for one of those charities, there is one quote which you'll never give, which is, well, I'm not too bothered by it, actually. I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah.
Possibly what you want to say,
but
you don't. You say, no, some of our members are deep, members of the X community, the permanently aggrieved community, are wildly upset by this, because, of course, that's your job.
Mm.
And the newspapers have thereby essentially synthesized a story out of the opinion of eight idiots possibly in the United States.
What did you mean when you said, I'm pretty sure you said this, the media is like food?
That was just a useful analogy, just for explaining how essentially the media diet that is available to us in communication is a much more varied and variegated diet than it ever was. You know, we grew up with sort of meat and two veg. Mm. What we now have is dips, sharing food, goodness knows what else. Mm. And the same thing has happened in the media. Now, interestingly, I argue against what the ad industry has mostly done, which is effectively the ad industry has barked at every passing car that technology has thrown up. Every time there's a new whizzy, shiny thing, the ad industry gets wildly excited and starts barking about it. Yeah. It starts a department of, you know, a Snapchat division or whatever it might be. You know, oh, we have to use, you know, rapidly disappearing photographs as mm-hmm. a new medium. My view is the opposite, that actually what we need to do is stop trying to actually create solutions around media. Instead, we've got to go back to basics, understand human psychology, motivation, and what causes people to act as they do, think as they do, mm-hmm. and decide as they do. Mm-hmm. And we've got to go back to the basics of human psychology, and then once we've understood that, we can decide which, if any, of these new media might be appropriate to solving the problem. Otherwise, we'll go mad, okay?
That links with, I read about the device that you were talking about inventing for mobile phones that would stop working when you walk into a car. I swear that was you.
That was me, yeah, it was in The Spectator. So I think there was a thing called Driver Mode, which you can download for Android.
Oh, you actually can now.
You can, yeah. No, but, I mean, interestingly, there is debate about having kind of Faraday... No, your car is a Faraday cage, isn't it? But creating kind of Faraday cagey-like things in the glove compartment, so you put your phone
in very cool.
and it can't pick up a signal. Bit unfair. That would be for the driver, not the passenger.
Yeah. Because I was going to say, is solving the problem in a product, or is it targeting the person's behaviour?
Well, the first thing is don't look at the media first, because where do you look? You don't know. There are too many of them. You can't tell until you've actually cut the patient open. You can't tell what the media solution is. So the first thing I would argue is go and look at the behaviour you wish to change and work out what are the forces, social, environmental, etc., that are currently acting against you.
Instagram.
And remove those forces. and then you might say, well, actually, as luck may have it, there happens to be a medium which allows us to do this very efficiently, which is X. Okay. Now, what I don't like is doing the damn thing backwards, which is starting an agency which is obsessed with Instagram and then looking for problems to solve. That's essentially doing it the wrong way around. Now, there is a caveat I make here. You do need to know what media are available and have a reasonable view of what the menu contains. Mm-hmm. But you should almost treat that as secondary until you've done the kind of dietary analysis. So you need a good, you need a good dietitian mm-hmm. before you look mm-hmm. at the menu, mm-hmm. essentially.
Yeah.
And what's often happening is people are hawking things from the menu, regardless of where the problem actually lies. In many cases, by the way, the solution won't even lie with bought media at all. I mean, there are plenty of solutions now where you can just say, actually, the reason this is happening is because of X. Mm-hmm. If you remove X or stop doing it, mm-hmm. the problem will go away.
Is there a case for a 4-day work week?
Yes. Yes, because we don't even know whether it wouldn't be economically beneficial. If people spend their money on leisure goods rather than on possessions, the provision of leisure services is more labour intensive than the provision of goods. Mm-hmm. So it may actually create more employment and circulate wealth better than having a 5-day work week.
What country is making the best advertising?
At the moment, weirdly, it's harder and harder than ever to generalise. But Brazil and Latin America have always had some fantastic stuff. One of the possible reasons being in Brazil is simply that I think media independents are illegal.
Are you successful?
To the extent which is, if I fell off a cliff tomorrow, I wouldn't feel I'd wasted my life. Yeah.
Have you ever failed?
Yes, lots.
Do you ever have shit ideas?
Oh yeah, really shit ideas, yeah. Not only that, you have to have some shit ideas.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the ridiculous ideas are either a route to something better, or the most vital thing in an ad agency is you have a culture where it's okay to fail or be silly. The main value of an advertising industry to the wider economy may not lie in actually producing advertising. It may lie in creating a culture wherein which you can make stupid suggestions and still get promoted. Now, a lot of business culture has a culture where one or two stupid or silly things are career destroying.
Mm.
We actually have to make being a bit dumb occasionally career enhancing. I don't care what your solution is if it's interesting. Now, it may be totally impossible to enact, it may be ethically unacceptable to enact it, we won't enact it in that case. Nonetheless, your ability to come up with those things is still important in terms of your general value.